on?
We had a lot of things to decide on. What type of film, what type of instrumentation. I was pushing the button to change the slides. Would you change the next slide, please? And focus. We built some apparatus to hold the camera so that we wouldn't provide any distortion into it to keep it geometrically correct. And that took us quite some time. We made this out of angle iron. Tom, it didn't cost very much. I heard Father Ottobein tell me one time that this cost like $30,000 or $40,000. And it was more like $15.95, I think. But it had some kind of interesting things. We built some levelers here. When they told me that this investigation would take place in a 15th century palace, I thought of dungeons, you know, in movies and the things you'd read, and I thought of cobblestone floors and so forth. So we put about a 2-foot leveling screw on all four points here to compensate for that adjustment. And there was an upright that held the camera, and it was divided off into increments here. And then this horizontal piece would allow us to move along the rail to predetermined positions, enabling us to divide the 14-foot section of cloth into 60 equal-sized 30-centimeter sections. We positioned lighting here across the way, and we tested several types of light, trying to get the ideal spectra that would respond to the cameras, and that light that would stay the same throughout the experiment, and that we could duplicate and verify in the laboratory. Another piece of elegance that I like is this little projection, telescoping projection here. Again, in order to square off to the flat frame, we could take measurements and move this back and forth, but we built this extension and we would go to the extreme four corners and just extend that out and get to the same location, and that way square up to the frame. If any of you ever have an occasion to photograph a shroud, I can highly recommend that method. Could you change the slide now, please? And focus. Now this is the plan again, and shows these 60 centimeter sections, and they had overlapping areas so that none of the shroud would be missed, or at least we had planned that not to be missed. And this is the replica slide, a photograph of the replica shroud. None of us had seen a shroud at that time, and I thought that it might look something similar to this, and I was pleasantly surprised that it didn't. But it shows the various areas and how these were divided up. And we divided them in the spectra in red, green, and blue, and we would travel through, kind of fly by that in a photogrammetric fashion, and photograph each one of those, and then later combine it via the computer into a mosaic image. Slide, please. I knew that was going to happen. I'm using the slides to remind me what to talk about next, so I have to be quiet at this point. Oh, Al says that if you take a quarter out of your pocket...
Another professional teacher.
Alan, I teach that that system.
That same trick. You notice how it always happens with the material about one day before you give an exam that you want to cover for them because you want to ask a question on it?
I notice too when people... I'm making kind of light of this now, and I don't think I could at this particular time. There's a lot of my friends out here that I don't want to embarrass. And Barry says he's taping me. Well, I might have to say something if this doesn't go on. I think the last slide was that mosaic that we practiced on, and I would say that then we started to select the films and we went through available films. Wow, that is not me or anything about that. Well, I know now that I'm going to talk about that. There were available films, of course, from the manufacturer that were over-the-counter types of film, and What we had heard from the various requesters and investigators that a film with high resolution and one that was responsive to all wavelengths of light would be what would want it, and that the image on the shroud was very subtle in subtle tones, all in about one color, so we wanted a film that would give a little bit of contrast to that, a little higher slope. So I first approached the Polaroid Corporation, and they gave me an awful lot of film to practice with, Polaroid films that had this ideal slope in it, and that allowed us to pick the best contrast range of film that we could use. I was going to talk about that picture. There we go. Okay, this is the rail in place, and it shows the lighting. The lighting had to be portable, and we could move it along and carry it over to Europe as well. Down the slide, please. We finally decided on a film of 70 millimeter capacity because we had to make a lot of pictures, and again, portability. And Eastman Kodak had a new special order film called SO-115 at that time, and it had a resolution of about 300 line pairs per inch, and it seemed to fit all of the requirements we needed, so we started practicing with that film. And this is a digitized print from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory of the replica image, and it shows a histogram of tones below it there. There's no routines played on this at all, no enhancement, but it shows the type of imagery that you can get through digitized photography, through computer photography, as opposed to normal silver photography. And one of the great advantages is that through this method we can measure over 200 different shades of gray, and in photography it's only slightly at best over 15. So there should be more information in a digitized photograph than in a normal silver photograph. Okay, next slide. Well, this is at the Royal Palace, and we're assembling all of the equipment here. Sam and Don and I leveling with those 2-foot leveling screws, and lo and behold, we had very nice parquet floors that were extremely level, and none of that was really needed. Slide, please. And this is the camera, all in position, and the lighting equipment. I think I can afford to tell you this story now about that lighting. Is it all right now, Tom, to tell that? I've held this for so long, and I don't want you to know that everything went absolutely so well. Not only was the equipment held up in customs in Milan, but one of the crates never arrived. And that one crate, I had a premonition wouldn't have come, because I know that it was shipped a little bit out of sequence with the rest. And that crate was the one that contained the lighting for this whole part of the investigation. And so for 3 days, I chased all over this strange city to me, of Turin, 700,000 people that all spoke Italian, trying to locate a replacement for this lighting so that the experiment could go on. And I tried to tell everybody, you know, my predicament on the team, but they all had their own problems. Didn't want to listen to mine. Eric Jumper told me to go on without it. Said, well, what difference do the lights make? It was a little comical to go into a camera store and tell them, you know, what I wanted in English, and these lights, and they were flashlights. They're xenon tube lights, and I would go flash, flash, or something. And they brought out a variety of little things to try to sell me. Well, there's got to be an end to this. It didn't seem like it at that time, but the National Geographic was there to cover the event, and person that has become a great friend to me. At least I kneel down to him now for providing that equipment, was Ken Weaver and Mickey Sweeney and Vic Boswell. We're in Turin, and they lent me their equipment that they had brought over to photograph the shroud, and we were able to go on. On Wednesday, the third day of the investigation, the crate finally did arrive after about 7 trips to Milan, several speeding tickets, and I don't know how much money to the various palms. Okay, so I couldn't help but tell you that when I looked at those 2 packets of lights. I know that this was Wednesday because we have the lighting. Next slide, please. And this shows the sandbags. We brought over bags to hold, in case there were any earthquakes, to hold that equipment steady. We only brought the bags, and we used Italian sand, and it seemed to work okay. Okay, and the next slide. Now, this is Don's famous step wedge, and John Lohr holding it for us, and he says that that will become the most famous photograph in the world. All humor aside, I know the impact of these photographs, and if you stop to think of it, Barry, you know, I think that more people have gazed on these pictures than almost any other pictures that have been produced in history. Next slide, please. And the final one. Next, please. This is the special filters, the dichroic filters that allowed only a 100 angstrom band, wide band of light to pass through. And we positioned those on carefully so that they didn't angle and change the response. Next slide. Now, another responsibility beyond that of spectral photography was to make photomicrographs, and this was for the first time in history that we knew of that photomicrographs had been made, and there was no instrumentation that is off the shelf for that type of job. Now, one of the restrictions that had been explained to me very carefully is that we would not be permitted to touch the cloth or do any harm, of course. And all the microscopes that I had seen and worked with were vertical microscopes where you would place an object, a specimen, on the stage. Not being able to do that with the shroud, there was no way that I knew that we could do photomicrography. And we devised some other simple methods that we could do photomicrography without a two-lens system, but nothing to get the high magnification needed to study particles there. And about a week before we left for the dry run here in Amston, I ran across the manufacturer of this instrument, which is called a Wild microscope, and he felt sorry for us and gave us an instrument to disassemble and to reassemble in a horizontal mode, and that's the instrument that we use to make these wonderful photographs. Next slide, please. Sam Pellicori will be talking about those and showing some of them tomorrow. We also made pictures with transmitted light where the panels were removed and the light was beamed through, and this provided a different kind of data. It showed how the blood stains stood out from the body image. It differed so that the surface qualities could be studied. We made photographs of that. If you'll make the next change, please. We could see styrations in the weave, a difference in the weave that gave us some clues to how the cloth itself was made. And these are horizontal and vertical styrations, as well as the various stain reflectivity. Slide, please. Now, I guess we could call these artistic pictures. We made these with National Geographic equipment, and we were able to photograph the shroud with the 8x10 cameras, large format cameras, and these are the ones that were printed in the National Geographic. Slide, please. The film was processed at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory with their equipment. We didn't want to risk doing it with small film processors. There was 7 rolls of 75-foot, 70-millimeter film exposed, and it'll all have to be done very carefully and in the same manner. So we went to the laboratories there that was processing the Voyager films and processed all the film. And I could tell you some of the problems, but I'm not going to bore you with that. So if you'll go to the next slide. These are some examples of the most boring of the pictures. I'm saving the best ones for last. But this shows the differences of the image, the appearance of the image through the various colors. And what we discovered, but knew really before we did this, that low frequencies increased the contrast. The shorter the frequency, the higher the contrast, and as we approached the same color as the stain, as you got into the reds, the contrast started to deteriorate and the image would not separate as well. Slide. You can run through these very fast because they're this would be ventral and dorsal images. This is with the blue of the red-green blue was the highest contrast and showed the greatest differences. The UV, of course, would show even more so. And the red, the less contrast from body image. But of course, the red would penetrate the blood stains better and into the red areas, and we could see details there. Keep going. These were the UV reflectance pictures. This is John Lohr at the image processing lab at Jet Propulsion, and he's digitized some of the pictures, as Don Lynn had said today, and I have some examples of those digitized photographs. Try to focus that, please. Now, these are very difficult to tell these from a normal silver photograph. There has been no routines played on them, but it shows the recorded imagery. And this now can be sent to various labs, and several different routines can be played. You can go through these too. Okay, this is where I'd like to stop, and this shows a mechanical enhancement that increases the detail, shows the detail above the background level. It coincides with the dimensionality that John was talking about today, that you can almost see that in a two-dimensional form, that three-dimension, the cylindrical lighting on the body. All of the photographs, I've been trained my eye to see that by themselves. And I have these photographs on display at the exhibit, and I certainly invite everyone here to come by and look at them, and I'd like to talk about them with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Hearn. We'd like to continue at this point with a discussion of the photomicrography. Sam, are you going first, or is Mark Evans going first? No. Well, then Agent X is back on the platform.
Coming on. That does make the house very dim. Difficult to see these. Can I have all the lights down? You're going to have to skip until we get to the right slides. Keep going. Yeah. Okay, go back three now. Yeah, that's where we're going to start. Okay, Mark Evans, who is not here, is actually responsible for the photomicroscopy. Vern already showed you the instrument. I would like to turn this light off. The problem is the photomicroscopy images are quite faint, and I'm going to break this light in order to maximally appreciate it. Okay. Focus, please. These are photo documentation exposures made by Barry to keep track of where we were taking exposures. You see the tip of the nose is one area that's being studied, the blood stain there, and off-image area. Next. There'll be a photo of this very dense blood stain at the small of the back and some other areas. Next. And on the blood on the foot. Okay, let's go to the next one. Okay, go on. Now, this is the blood at the small of the back. I'm sorry, at the lance wound. What you can see are clumps of reddish material.
Focus.
Could you focus, please? And you also see that the shroud itself is a very tight weave. The reddish material is caught in the fibrils. It is caught in the bends and turns of the weave. Next. This is another bloodstain area. You can see that the tops of, or the crowns of the threads have very little material. Apparently this material was braided off during the repeated foldings and during the ages. Focus again. A lot of reddish material caught in the fibrils. This area is the in the small of the back. Next. At lesser magnification, this is approximately 2x on the original slide. Also in the small of the back. Notice the rather reddish color we've been showing so far. And also the blotchiness. There's a much denser concentration there than here. Next. On the dorsal foot area, this is blood again. I'm going to let you study these for a few seconds. Okay, next. You can see the weave very clearly, and also notice it is quite a tight weave. The threads are somewhat flattened, as opposed to modern linen, which would have the threads more with a circular cross-section. Next. We had some difficulty with the photomicroscopy because although Vern was very pleased to have a parquet floor, turns out it was very flexible floor. So whenever anybody moved in the room, the image in the microscope danced, and we had to tell everybody to freeze while we were taking an exposure. The exposures were made with xenon lamps to provide a white light, and as you see, color slide film was used, and the film was processed at the Brooks Institute in Santa Barbara. Many copies were made. The originals are being retained by Mark Evans. And an article was published with this information, with photos, in Archaeology magazine, the January-February 1981 issue. It has the full color photos that I'm showing you now. I think all of us would admit to wanting more data. We've done, I think, a good job, but it's always the case in an investigation that you just don't have enough data. So if we went back, I certainly would want more photomicrographs of different areas. This is the first body image. This is the tip of the nose. And you can see quite a different character. There is a brownish or dark yellowish, plus also some red specks and even some darker specks in this area. This is one of the densest image areas on the body. This is at 64x magnification on the original slide. That is as high as we could go. Next. This is another image area. It is the right eye. Focus, please. You can see how underdense, how very faint the image coloration is. And in fact, the image coloration resides only in the upper fibrils, the upper three or four fibrils, approximately 5/1000ths of an inch in total depth. It does not go around the bends in most, well, almost every case. It is only on the topmost fibrils. Also, you'll begin to see more clearly that it occurs in clumps of colored yellowed fibrils. There are areas adjacent to these colored areas that are not colored. For example, here's a colored area and there's not. There'll be better examples to be seen. This is what the body image looks like. There are essentially no particulate materials that can be seen. Okay, next. Yep. I should say that the threads are composed of microfibrils, which are about 10 to 15 micrometers in diameter. That's about a 0.5 of an inch in diameter. And a bunch of these go up to make a thread. It looks like a major problem. They've taken the whole cassette out and they're turning it upside down. Okay.
Olive oil on the slide.
That should help. It's when you scorch them that they deform, get stuck in them. So that's a very important characteristic we are seeing on the body image, namely that it is only in the upper fibrils. It is an underdense coloration or discoloration. Essentially, no particulates are caught in the fibrils, and the discoloration does not go around the bends. This area is what I call the dirty heel area. Indeed, in this case, you have some particulates caught in the fibrils. These may be either dirt or indeed blood particles. This is a very dense image. Under very high magnification such as this, on a flexible object, it's difficult to have everything in focus at once. So you're just sort of going to focus on areas that are in the focal plane of the microscope. That explains why some of the threads are not sharp. Okay, next. This is also a foot area and illustrates concentration of coloration adjacent to essentially uncolored. So you have a striped effect in the body image. Next. I think this is another eye image. This is the right eye again. Focus. You see the banding or the striped effect. So you have a very tenuous image. One very unlike what you would expect if somebody had used a paintbrush to apply a pigment. Next. Okay, we also took photographs of water stains for comparison. And in contrast to the body image, the water stain coloration focus does penetrate. It goes around the bends. And in fact, we were able to look at the backside of the cloth and verify that both the blood stains and the water stains do penetrate to the backside. The body image does not. The body image, as I mentioned, is only essentially 5/1000ths of an inch deep. The water stain is quite unlike the body stain. It is also browner. Next. This is another, well, this is the water stain showing that the water came from your left to right, and as the water evaporated, just simply dropped the particulates it was carrying. So you have an increase in density here. The water stains have density to X-rays, as Bill Modern showed us earlier. And this is the cloth with no stain. Doctors Adler and Heller will tell us what some of the materials